I want to tell you a story about the First Amendment. The story I would like to tell you would start in 1981 on May the 11th, 1981. That's the day I walked over to City Hall and raised my right hand and took an oath to defend the Constitution and enforce the laws of the state of Maryland. But it didn't start in 1981, my lesson about the Constitution, more specifically the First Amendment. And it didn't start in my fifth year either. It didn't start in my 10th year. It didn't start in my 15th or 20th or 25th. My lesson about the First Amendment really occurred on October 4th, 2011, in a very narrow strip of real estate, a piece of concrete that fronts a dysfunctional water fountain at the intersection of Pratt and Light Streets. It's a place called McKeldin Square. On October 4th, 2011, a group of folks came to occupy that space, quite literally. And the folks came very eclectic, with a rabble of signs and slogans and mantras borrowed in part from their counterparts to the north. And it was quite fascinating to watch until we discovered that they brought with them tents. And they erected the tents, and along the pavement, right along Pratt Street there, and along the sides, some pretty cool tents too, and they seemed quite determined. And I have to tell you that in the first few days of it, I was caught up in the fascination of it, until someone reminded me that camping in a park is illegal. But I wasn't thinking about that at the time. I was fascinated as an American that these folks were here in Baltimore. They were making a stand here in Baltimore. We're not really known for these sorts of things. And hard to get people really motivated to do much. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. But not everybody thought it was cool. And some of my bosses didn't think it was so cool. And so they started asking me at the end of that first week, what are you going to do about the campers? I thought, you know, I think I'm not going to do anything about the campers. And they, I had to think why I'm not going to do something about the campers. And I started to contemplate why they were there. At first, it didn't occur to me about their First Amendment. At first, I have to tell you that the notion about escalating tuition costs and jobs and the fact that this country has been blinded by incarcerating people ad nauseum while bankers haul away billions of dollars. I thought, they really do have a story to tell. I'm quite interested in hearing it. And then as the criticisms mounted and the pressures mounted, even internally, people started saying, you can't let them stay. We can't let them stay. They can't stay there. You have to do something. And I watched with interest as my colleagues across the country started grappling with this problem. I watched on college campuses as they sprayed the kids with pepper mace and tried to drag them to police vans, and watched in cities as they were firing tear gas at Americans. And I thought, this, it's wrong. It's wrong. And I remember being in Chicago, and we were, the police chiefs around the country were sharing emails and updates about what was occurring. The big fear was that somehow this would turn into a terrorist movement, that this was perhaps anarchy, the beginning of anarchy again in America. And I was in Chicago, and I was riding, sharing a cab with another police chief. And he said, isn't it ironic that we are the guys that are holding back the people from going in there and hauling these people off and evicting them? Isn't it ironic that the chiefs are the ones that are counseling that we should wait, and that people have rights to assemble? They have rights to be heard. They have rights for redress. Isn't it ironic we're the ones that are defending that? And I flew back from Chicago thinking, it's not ironic. That's exactly what I did in 1981. I swore that I would defend their right to do that. I swore I would do that. And so we had meetings and meetings and meetings and meetings about what we're going to do about the folks in the camp. And I thought that the line for me was going to be that as long as they were engaged in that, we should give them that voice, that I, at least from my vantage point, would defend their right to do that. And that they would do it in a manner that was safe. They would do it in a manner that was safe, not just to everyone else. They couldn't run out in the street and bang on cars. And they had to be mutually respectful to each other. I thought the weather might affect all of that, but it didn't. And October turned into November. And November started to loom on to December. And some of the conditions in the camp started to deteriorate. There were fewer and fewer of the people who really had something to say. And it became a place where the homeless got to hang out in some really cool tents. And some of the homeless brought with them the same sort of stuff that they do under 83, stab each other and take stuff from each other. And it started to devolve. And so I knew that at some point it was going to be untenable. We had done things like turn off the electricity, so the homeless weren't charging cell phones, so they didn't seem to mind. So we knew that wouldn't work. And we made some pitch about you have to file a fee or file notice, but they didn't file notice to sleep on Baltimore Street or in front of City Hall, so that didn't work much either. So we started prepping. I started prepping with the police, and I set up some rules, because I had watched what we had done, my colleagues had done around the country, and I was embarrassed by it. And I had some rules. And the first rule was no dogs. There was no way I was going to unleash German shepherds to bite Americans camping out in that square. The second rule was no weapons. If we encountered weapons, we would respond accordingly, but I wanted them to be able to remove the people, evict the people with the minimum amount of force necessary. So the one thing that we did observe was that the common tactic, and we had seen in passing that they had rehearsed this a few times, like if a cop walked through, they would give some code word and everyone would quickly assemble. So we knew that they had practiced some of that. And I had watched that what the common tactic was be that they would sit down and link arms, a very classical form of nonviolent resistance, passive resistance. And so I challenged our officers. We put together a team of people that could go in and break that sort of thing up. But remember, my rule was no weapons. They couldn't use a club to beat them into submission. They couldn't douse them with pepper spray. And they came back to me after about 2 weeks, and they said, "We're ready." I said, "Are you sure you're ready?" They said, "Absolutely, we can do it." I said, "Great. Tomorrow be at the police academy, and you're going to demonstrate it." They said, "Great." So showed up at the police academy. I showed up there. And I went into an academy class, and I randomly picked nine of the recruits, some big, some little, some tall, some short, all different sizes, men, women, different races. And I said, "Come with me." And I took them into a room, and I said, "Here's the deal. These SWAT guys, they've been practicing this stuff for weeks, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to link arms and link our legs, and we're going to scream and yell real loud, and they're going to try to pull us apart. And your job is to resist that. You can't punch them, can't spit on them, but you could do everything else." And so I had this kid next to me. I had this kid next to me, very close-cut hair and real squared away, and I learned that he was a Marine. And so my son's a Marine, and my dad was a Marine. I've known a few Marines, so I told him as we sat down, he was like, "I'm next to you, sir. I'm next to you, sir." And I said, "Marine, you're not allowed to die in the exercise." And so he sat next to him. He's like, "Yes, sir." And so we link arms. I'm thinking, all right, this is cool. You know, I got a good team here, of a diverse team. And we were standing around acting, you know, the part. The SWAT team shows up. We drop and link arms. And they saved me for last. And, you know, so I'm there on the floor. I'm trying to curl up in a ball. And they did it. They did it with their bare hands and were able to convince me to get my rear end up off the mat and go with them. So I thought, okay, we're ready. But that wasn't enough. We were worried that people would come and assemble from around the area. So if a call went out, more people would come in. It would turn into a thing. And what I really wanted to accomplish was no force, no arrests. No force, no arrest. And that you would go to bed that night on December 14th, at 13th, December 13th. Thank you. Part of the Occupy movement here. So that you would go to bed on December 13th, and you would go to bed and actually on the 12th, and wake up on the morning of the 13th, and they would be gone. That was my goal, that they would be gone, and do it as quietly as possible. So we trained the team that was going to remove people if we had to, and we trained a guy that would go in and try to talk them out, and then we trained a perimeter team of about 100 officers that we hand-selected in the department. These are the guys that you heard about with riot gear, and their job really was to protect the perimeter of the event. And we trained those guys and trained those guys. We had trial call-outs to test to see if the operation would get compromised. So I said to them, "We're going tonight. Get the team." And we did this like a week in advance, and they called the team together, and no one heard anything about it. So I thought, okay, cool. We really can do this, and no one will find out. So the day came, and the appointed hour, and we were going to do it at 3 o'clock. So we had the staging area, and I was with some other folks near the Hyatt Regency. And what I wanted to do was to be able to watch the thing myself and be close enough that if something went wrong, then I could interject very quickly. So I walked along the catwalk near the Hyatt Regency, and I climbed up there. It's at 3 o'clock, and when I come around the corner, we had been hiding and staying back, and the radio says, "They're coming, they're coming, they're coming up Light Street, we're coming." And just as they're getting to the scene, I popped out and looked at the camp, and lined all along Pratt Street and lined all along in front of the steakhouse were camera crews. I thought, "You bastards. How is this possible?" At any rate, it worked out to our advantage. And what ultimately happened was that a commander from the department went inside the camp, woke everyone up, and was able to convince them to leave. We had a bus there offering city services to the homeless folks to take them to a shelter. And we convinced everybody in the camp to leave peacefully. And not a single arrest was made. Not a single arrest. And people will say to me, in terms of my experience as police commissioner, that you were the guy that did something about reducing homicides in Baltimore. I love the way you talked about bad guys with guns. But I have to tell you that probably the single most satisfying moment of my life was when that last American walked out of that camp without handcuffs. Thank you.